for the time frame, Jennifer mentioned Westat started with us in 2004, I believe.
Well, we started the development, I think, about a year prior to that.
Okay.
So
you're probably wondering what happened way back in 1990s. So here we have our next presenter, who's actually the first one to give us a little bit kind of background information, is Steve Campbell.
Good morning. You don't have to settle in and prepare for me going through 100 pages of survey questions that Jennifer talked about. I'll just highlight a couple of how we operationalize
the state.
But I did want to mention, actually, it's true what Jennifer was saying about they're completely a web component. ATP internally in 1999, I think, and Gene can correct me if that's wrong, switched to its own web-based application. It was run in-house at NIST through the Information Technology Lab. So we had already moved toward a web-based component. The redesign integrated some other questions we had used from other surveys and revisited some things of use to project management. So it wasn't, we were actually into the web world slightly before that. But. Right, so I'll just quickly, we're going to go through and highlight a few specifics about, call it the ATP mission and some more general research interest we had in understanding innovation and entrepreneurship. We'll do a couple examples of, call it, hard measures and soft measures, see how we operationalize some of these concepts. And I'll try to give you a flavor for a couple of the surveys of some of the regression analysis we did and what were some of the takeaways from the fuller analysis that we did. So I decided to kind of break this up into two types of analysis. One, call it, I'll borrow this word from Stephanie, call it process analysis. It's not looking at how you might think of process in the sense of how did you process 800 applications for being awarded in a four-month period, but it's more about how does our selection process work relative to mission. And then the second part would be, call it project evaluation of, given you've selected these projects, how well are they performing, what is it you're going to measure, and what are some of those determinants of success? And are those determinants of success nicely matched up with the reason you were picking them in the first place, which would be a nice thing to discover if that were true, and if not, where do we need to make corrections? So there are, these are just some of the selection criteria. I use that term loosely. This room is loaded with people who were at ATP and involved in the selection process, so I know they're looking at this and thinking, that's not really the criteria we score on, and that's true. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to everybody else. Loosely enough, it kind of gets at these measures of ATP wants to fund and get some measures for innovativeness, whether something's high risk. We encourage longer-term research horizons. We're interested in fostering collaboration, have these benefits be fairly broad-based and diffused to multiple technologies. And for the sensitivity reasons that Rosalie talked about and the political concern, there was always an emphasis on explaining why the need for ATP was there in the first place. We had some counterfactual examples as to how you would try to get at that question. So the two things on this selection process, we employed a survey of all ATP applicants, and we've fielded this survey through Westat three times, in the 2000 competition, the 2002 competition, and the 2004 competition, where we surveyed both awardees and non-awardees. We also, of course, have access to administrative data about the proposals, as well as how external reviewers reviewed these proposals, which we could use for our analysis. I do want to mention that I think ATP is fairly unique in its efforts to go ahead and try to find and survey non-awarded companies. I think many programs across the federal government have a difficult enough time going to talk to the people that they gave money to. You're likely not to find complete results on that, let alone trying to follow up who didn't get an award and figure out what was your, and this was how you at some level can get this counterfactual control group analysis, look at people that won an award, look at people that didn't win an award. You kind of have a sense of the characteristics of the projects and how well they were evaluated on quality. You kind of run these through things together, come revisit them about 18 months after the competition and start comparing where those that received the money are on some elements and where those that didn't receive the elements. And again, what that the administrative data was so important because it gives us some sense and some ability to control for the quality of the proposal. Because presumably, you know, the stronger proposals won, so we need some control to begin to address that. So I'm going to go through two examples of how we operationalized two of these concepts in the applicant surveys. One is, you know, how do you get your hand around whether something is high risk or not? So we were interested in a quantitative, call it a hard measure, for the risk the company saw on the ATP project as proposed, as well as what a typical project is at their company, what their risk tolerance is for that. On the selection side, we were curious, does ATP, is it in fact funding the higher risk projects? And are we funding those projects where each company is stretching their risk profile? If you're always doing high risk research, you need to stretch yourself even more, your comfort, even past, farther past your comfort level to have the ATP funding occur. So these are the two ways we operationalize the questions. You can read them there. So we want them to base it on from 0 to 100% the probability that the project's going to fully achieve the goals and answer that same question for a typical project, a typical R&D project at their company. The risk measure by inference then is kind of 100 minus the probability you do everything you said you would do. And I know when in developing these questions, there was always the concern about what methodologists may call social desirability, right? They know that you wanted to fund high-risk projects, so we're going to give you the answer about high-risk projects. We're going to have, you know, probabilities reflecting that. And I don't want to, you know, downplay that and say that's not a possibility, but from our looking at the data and from we were designing the survey, there doesn't seem to be anything systematic across technology types, across awardees or non-awardees that would drive that result, right? If they're interested in lying to us that they were doing high-risk stuff, everybody's interested in lying to us, right? Or at least it's, you know, randomly distributed who's interested in lying to us. So we did have those concerns, but we did numerous tests across different characteristics to see if we saw major differences, and we really didn't. So one takeaway summary stat here was, that's not too foggy, the redder one is the proposed ATP project versus the typical. So the two takeaways were, yes, ATP was selecting and awarding those companies with the higher levels of risk. And it also appeared to be the case that, yes, they're also selecting those that were stretching themselves more than their typical. So, you know, we were generally, you know, pleased to see that result. We also did an analogous measure for time horizon and the way we tried to operationalize how long the R&D time horizon was to say, you know, how many years after the start of your project could you expect the results to first have an impact on revenues? And we do that again for the ATP project and for a typical project at the company, however they want to define that, whether it's their kind of median time horizon or the technology or the challenge that's closest to the ATP. That's self-defined by the respondent, and all we can ask is that they're internally consistent. So we did see, generally speaking, yes, that the ATP awardees had a longer or stretched time horizon, right? We were, in fact, selecting on those that were moving the time horizon out. And that ended up being true even when you control for whether it's a single company project of 3 years or a joint venture project of 5 years, even controlling for that administrative constraint. Yes, we were selecting on those that were stretching the company's time horizon. The results were also there, but not as strong for stretching them in terms of normally it's a 3-year window for us, but for ATP it's a 4-year window. There was some evidence of that, but not as strong as there was on the risk side. And I do want to mention one thing. Richard commented about, call it the market failure. Both for time horizon and risk, we also asked questions in the applicant surveys to try to get them to put some numbers around what the expected benefit was to their company 2 years after the project ended and 5 years after. They had categories of various amounts, you know, less than 100,000, 100,000 to half a million. What we were interested in seeing was to what extent we could observe a very nice risk-reward trade-off or a time horizon reward trade-off. And the result was not that strong. There wasn't that strong of evidence that, yeah, very low risk ones had lower returns, the very high risk ones had higher returns, which I think may, to me at least, speaks to something about this market failure notion. If I'm of the belief that there's no market failure here, it's a risk reward trade-off. Well, even for companies who this is their, what they're doing, high risk R&D, these are squishy measures, right? They have a sense what the risk is, but it often changes when they go through. They have a sense what the reward is, but 2 years into the project, the market has changed and shifted on them, and that even if they were doing expected value calculations up front, that changes by the time the project gets finished. And we have asked awardees in some of our newer surveys up front, do you ever do internal rate of return calculations as a general rule? If so, what's your hurdle rate? And what you find is so many companies are saying, not really. And we have some general sense, but we don't do the hard numbers for you to provide that. So, sorry?
Those are the ones going out of business?
Well, hopefully not. I mean, if we're getting an answer from Motorola, I assume that's not correct, or GE, but there are... Yeah, that may be, and that was a real concern. It may be that the ones that are doing, we just didn't see any correlation between projects that were going gangbusters on patenting and commercialization, which those were the ones that had some very routinized and mechanized and hard number for that. So to look at some of the regression analysis of the selection process, we did more fuller control for some of these variables, and these were the takeaways really fairly consistently across all three surveys. Okay, one was, yes, we were funding projects with greater risk and longer time horizon. They were able to leverage an ATP award to attract additional funding, what we were calling a halo effect. And we were finding evidence. There are external reviewers that do reviews for us. They give us some sense and some scoring of, yes, we think it's fundable, no, we don't think it is. Our evaluation panels take another look at that and trim that pool even more. And what we found is our evaluation panels are putting additional premium on, you know, measures we had for innovativeness and risk. So it's kind of a validation of our selection panels. When it comes to project success, I'll speed up. I got the 2-minute warning from Richard. We hit a whole host of characteristics. We asked questions about key personnel to see what roles they were playing, their human capital accumulation, company characteristics, project characteristics in terms of risk, time horizon, the things we saw on the applicant survey, measures of their research effort, project management questions like, are you changing your goals? Did you have to redo this or that? And capturing the traditional hard outputs that most of you would think about, patent applications, issued patents, scientific publications, revenues, cost savings, licensing royalties. And we tried to get a sense of profit margins, and we were quite surprised when we tried this question, how many companies gave us a profit margin not only for their proposed technology, but also, in general, in this line of business that the ATP is generally in, what's your profit margin, which would enable us to get a better feel for what the ATP value added is. You take the revenues. It's not just the revenues. It's the profit part of those revenues as well as the cost and the licensing. So one of the squishier measures that we tried to get after was, you know, how quickly does technical know-how and research results get diffused? Categories within 2 years, 2 to 5 years, et cetera. And the takeaway was, yeah, it kind of confirmed our prior that we may have had, which is research results diffuse a lot more quickly than, call it, the know-how or the harder internalized knowledge that you get. But one thing I found interesting was even we also asked questions about how a company is going to capture value from their innovation. And even those companies that indicated the primary source is going to be trade secret, they're obviously not relying on that indefinitely. because very few people are piling on to this is going to be good enough for 10 years or so before the know-how or some of this information gets out. So it does give us a little better sense as to which means of capturing value are most effective. And we did similar things. You can check these slides out on the wiki, and please do. Well, we were interested in, Rosalie was talking about there's stuff that took place before ATP, stuff that happened on ATP, and a lot of stuff that has to take place after ATP. And that makes it hard to isolate our impact when we're just one piece in this long chain. So we wanted to get a sense as to how much is left on the table when they're finishing up their project. And I guess maybe it was a little surprising to say there are a lot of technical challenges as well as non-technical challenges that remain when you're doing high-risk, very infrastructural R&D. It's like when ATP leaves the picture or left the picture, there's still a lot to do. And the question becomes, can companies then come up with the resources to do that? And it's not just on the non-technical, the business regulatory side. It's, there's still a lot of technical work to do. These results have been very robust across the post-project survey, 2, 4, and 6 years out, as well as the BRS survey during the projects. We've seen that small companies, more than the medium or large, were most likely to experience early revenues. Joint venture lead organizations and single company applicants perform very similarly. Joint venture partners tend to have less of the outcomes and outputs we were measuring. University participation in the project, which may not be surprising, has a positive effect on how we were characterizing knowledge creation and dissemination. And university participation had less likely of a chance that the project would be stopped for adverse reasons. And one thing, it's not a paradox, but we found that projects with greater measures of innovativeness and risk, call that closer to the scientific frontier, we're more likely to realize, technical and commercial outputs. So if you're going to aim for Mars, you might get the moon. If you aim for the moon, right, you might get nowhere. So that's kind of our take on that. And I'll do just a quick couple concluding thoughts. I agree that ATP was blessed to be a controversial program because it does hone and tighten your evaluation, and it makes you be a little more precise in how you think about these things. The flip side danger to me is that you can immediately move from measure against mission to measure against missiles, which are constantly incoming from your critics, right? And you don't want – you get surveys expanding and expanding because you heard these 8 criticisms over here. Let's get some questions to address that. Oh, they don't like this over here. And you want to be able to – sometimes you can't fight that, and that's what can happen in survey creep when you start, trying to deflect all of these missiles that are coming in. And the last point is that it is challenging to have this feedback loop or some ability to say what you learn in surveys and data analysis. How do you feed that back into your system? Because to the extent that you're constrained by your mission or that you're measuring against mission, sometimes you're going to turn up a result where the answer is, well so what, right? If I can find strong statistical evidence that companies in the Midwest with a left-handed CEO are doing poorly, right? It's like, all right. So does that mean I now have the ability to, through policy and other things, no more Midwest small companies with left-handed CEOs? You are kind of constrained on some of the answers you're going to get unless you can get back into the policy side of things and say, let's revisit some of the program goals and the program requirements. You can just keep bringing this up and bringing this up, but you have to work with those other people to say, okay, now it's time to make change.